The BS Report is presented by Subway. Football season is over. Footlong season is just beginning. For a limited time, get any piled high regular footlong for just $5. Any footlong, just $5. Hurry in, Subway. Eat fresh. Eat fresh. The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
All right, we're going to Hollywood route again today on the BS Report, and we have a guest on whose name that is one of those names that I'm not sure how to pronounce, but he's on the Subway Fresh Take hotline right now. Give me the exact pronunciation of your last name.
Honestly, I don't even know. Most people say sure.
Is it sure?
It's sure is fine, I honestly it changes every time I say it. I say Mike Shore sometimes. I say Mike Sure sometimes. I say Mike Shure, like someone who makes shoes.
So it's like an Andrea thing.
It's an Andrea thing that I couldn't care less about.
Yeah, you're okay with whatever. Okay.
Whatever you say will become the official way it's pronounced.
All right, cool. So you started Saturday Night Live, then you went to The Office, and now you're launching this new show with
Correct.
Amy Poehler, which has had like 17 different titles. What did you guys settle on?
We settled on Parks and Recreation.
Okay. We're going to talk about that in a second, but we got to talk about the Red Sox first, because you're
Please.
One of the biggest Red Sox fans on the planet.
That's
now,
true.
Ever since we didn't get to Shara, I have been saying and advocating that this was all going to lead to us stealing Miguel Cabrera from the economically depressed Detroit Tigers, which kind of makes me feel bad because it symbolizes kind of what's happening in America, like where the bigger cities are just crushing the cities that are in trouble. But
yeah.
On the other hand, they're paying.
Detroit hasn't had enough problems recently than
right.
often enough to go stealing its baseball players.
Yeah, we're going to hijack their best guy. On the other hand, they signed him to an 8-year, $153 million deal.
Yeah.
And now the news came out yesterday that their season tickets have gone from 27,000 in 2008 to 15,000 in 2009. Boy. And clearly they are just headed for one of the biggest economic disasters by any team in one season, because they have like a $125 million payroll. How the hell are they going to make that money? So I just think it's going to be a free-for-all, and the Red Sox are going to be sitting there. They're going to poach this guy. They'll probably force us to take Dontrelle Willis in the deal, and we'll give up like, you know, a mid-level prospect. As a Red Sox fan growing up hating the Yankees, do you feel good about this?
I have to say that when we didn't get to Shara, I was mostly what I felt was relief. I don't know if you experienced this or not, but I was like, I mean, he's a great player. He's fantastic. He would make the team so much better. But like every time you get those guys, the argument that you're not the Yankees gets harder and harder to make. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I have taken a lot of delight in the last few years from going, you know that blog called Cops Baseball Contracts. You ever go there? It's a great blog. I think it's mlbcontracts.blogspot.com or whatever. But when you go there, I delighted in looking at the Yankees payroll and seeing how many guys were year after year stretching on into seemingly infinity. It's 20 million, 20 million, 20 million, 20 million. And I don't like the way that feels when I imagine it, you know, and that's what Cabrera is. And obviously the guy's like 25 and he's unbelievably good at baseball, but like, I don't know, you look at that contract and you're like, do I want to pay that guy $22 million in 2017 or whatever it is? I don't know. I don't know if that's good.
On the other hand, though, we were all in denial because this is basically what we did with Manny Ramirez.
Yes, but he was the only guy. And Manny is such a crazy, weird anomaly in sports in general that I don't know, maybe this is rationalizing, but I was like, well, he's so entertaining. You know, he's not just a baseball player. He's
right.
Manny Ramirez is the funniest baseball player in the world. I talk with all my comedy writing friends, and I talk about this all the time. Like,
yeah.
By far the funniest baseball player. And in my head, they're paying him $14 million to hit and $6 million to entertain us.
I like that. That's a nice way of rationalizing it. Yeah, I mean,
definitely,
he's
It's definitely a rationalization, but that's what I came up with.
It was certainly a gaping hole when he left last season. All of a sudden,
agree.
It was like, yeah, this is now I'm just rooting for a baseball team.
I mean, I love Jason Bay, and I thought he did a great job, and I'm happy to have him on the team. And there was something nice about not having the constant feeling like if you were going to wake up and go to the Red Sox team page and read the craziest story you've ever read about Manny Ramirez.
Right.
But
Manny,
right.
Manny missing. Manny went on boat trip, gone. We don't know where he is.
Details yeah, like Manny buys own Gulfstream jet, flies around the world solo, misses 2 weeks. I was very sad when he left because it was just like, it was the craziest ride. Like, the story of Manny Ramirez on the Red Sox is just unbelievable, ending in, like, a World Series MVP. It's just ridiculous.
I agree. And then, you know, another World Series in 2007. And on top of that, you know, you could maybe even make the argument that the Big Poppy-Manny combo kind of peaked in 2007.
I think so, when
you
look
statistically, it was like, this is like Ruth and Gehrig all over again. We go into the winter. Everybody just loves Manny. Everybody's on board.
Yep.
Oh, my God. You know, we almost lost him a couple times, but thank God we didn't. And then just to watch it unravel in the span of it was like 4 months.
Quickly. Yeah, I know. I mean, I feel like someday somebody's going to write a true inside story. It'll probably be Schilling, but somebody's going to write a true inside story of what it was like to be with Manny, and I will not read it because some things are better left unknown. Like, I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but have you ever met, like, a personal hero or idol of yours in sports or entertainment or anything, and
yes.
They're just mean to you? And you're like, mm-hmm. Oh, man. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like the way that we experienced Manny Ramirez was the correct way, which was a little bit at a distance. That's the sense I get. But
yeah, I mean, you just described one of the reasons why I tried to write my column the way I've written it instead of the conventional way, because I really feel like a lot of these guys, as they get older, the sports writers and columnists, the more they hang out with these guys, the odds of them disliking 50% or whatever their percentage is, it's eventually going to color the way they write about sports.
Yeah, for positively and negatively. I mean, every time the Hall of Fame voting comes around, you read articles that are extremely pro somebody. It's usually Jack Morris is like the guy. And it's like, they try to make these arguments for Jack Morris, and then they go on to admit that, like, they're personal friends with Jack Morris, and they go golfing with Jack Morris, and they hang out with Jack Morris. And, well, it's like, of course you want your buddy to be in the Hall of Fame, you know? And it's like the lack of objectivity in journalism is like, I think it's a serious problem, and it's just because it's sports, and it's like pure entertainment, doesn't mean that people shouldn't try to evaluate things objectively. Like, that's a big pet peeve of mine.
Well, and another aspect of that is when they talk about when they're making the case for somebody, and part of the case is, and he always handled himself with grace with the media. If you needed a quote, you could always go to him. It's like, what? That's not on baseballreference.com. I don't, most times you could go to a guy for a quote. Just
yeah,
stupid.
It's like he makes a delightful stir fry.
Yeah.
I just think that is really one of the main things that we should take into consideration when we vote.
Well, what you just talked about was one of the main reasons I wrote the big piece that I wrote about Manny last September, because I felt like the people that were covering the story and the people that were coloring basically everybody's perceptions of what happened, it was one side of the story, and we were just hearing from people who had ties to the Red Sox.
Right, right.
I just thought it was a little incestuous, and just to hear over and over again what a bad guy this guy was, but not to hear the other side of it and not for anybody to point the finger at Boris was just bizarre to me.
Yes, I totally agree, and I never really understood until I moved to L.A. why anyone in the world in the entertainment industry would have a publicist. And then as soon as you move to L.A., you're like, oh, no, everyone needs a publicist. Like,
right.
There's just a way that, like, and, you know, we went through this a little bit during the writer's strike, actually, was like that, you know, the disagreement between the writers and the giant mega companies who you know, buy the content and put it on TV and in the movies. And they also, like, own a lot of the newspapers and stuff. And then you just suddenly felt like, oh, my God, there's no way for this to be accurately presented to the public, because the way that it gets presented to the public is through newspapers and radio stations and TV stations that these people own. It's like,
right.
You know, and I read that piece. I totally was on your side. I felt like, yeah, Manny's a goofball, and he's a weirdo, and he does a lot of weird things, but we're not hearing every side of the story, and they, like, it's just, it's not a healthy thing. You gotta dig past what is being presented to you by one source in order to figure out really what the story is.
And once upon a time, you had a baseball book. I won't mention the name, but a big part of that was kind of dissecting, you know, some of the cliches in media, or, you know, the kind of the hypocrisy of certain columns or whatever.
Did you
feel like this made anything tied into that?
I think that it was definitely in the wheelhouse, as you would say. I think that, like, I mean, our blog was mostly about, like, just people writing things that we thought were either just stupid and cliched, or were just absolutely not true and easily disprovable.
I was honored to make it a couple times.
You did
as a target. Yeah, I did. I was excited.
It wasn't for things that were untrue, though. We always thought of you as one of the good guys, because you had facts to back up whatever you were saying.
Most of the time,
yeah. But the Manny thing is like a more complicated version of. I mean, we were really a humor site, frankly. Like, we didn't try to, like, change the world or really get in deep into anything. But our goal was just to, like, when people would say, like, you know, that, hey, if you're facing the Cardinals, the guy that you can't let beat you is David Eckstein. It was like, no, it's Albert Pujols. I promise you, it's Albert Pujols. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
That was the kind of stuff that we made fun of, was just those people claiming that, you know, the one guy you don't want to face in the Cardinals lineup is David Eckstein, which, by the way, a lot of people claim.
Well, and also, when you guys started it, what year did you start? 2005?
April of 2005, yeah.
And statistically, the general public and most of the media hadn't really evolved yet. And they were still sticking by old stats and really had no comprehension of the newer stats.
Yeah.
And you guys could just easily dissect whatever argument and be like, well, actually, his whip is really good. And, you know, you throw out these little things like, well, this is why you're wrong because of this, this, and this, and this. But
yeah.
I think people have gotten a little savvier now statistically.
I think they're getting savvier every year. I mean, we by no means were like the vanguard of that. I mean, this
stuff
has been going on for 30 years and stuff, so we never wanted to try to take credit for it. But you're right. I mean, I think every year that goes along, I mean, you know, Joe Posnanski has a column, who's a big, you know, Saber guy, or at least knows how to throw the stats around. He's on the cover of the front page of, what is it? Is it CNN SI or is it ESPN? I can't remember.
SI.
He's got a regular column now.
Yeah.
You know, and the baseball prospectus guys have a little thing in SI every week. Like, it's getting more and more in the mainstream. It was for a while kind of like shooting fish in a barrel, where someone would write an article around the All-Star break and it's like, you know who the first half MVP is? It's Leivon Hernandez. You know, Leivon Hernandez has 12 wins. And you'd be like, his ERA is 7.5. Like, what are you talking about? So there still is that stuff, but I think you're right. I think people get a little better at, a little smarter every year.
I'm torn on it because, on the one hand, I love it and I like reading about it and I think it's interesting. On the other hand, I think it's removed, because baseball is really the one sport that you can evaluate through statistics, because it's an individual sport. So it's kind of removed any sort of opinion I'm allowed to have that's subjective. You know what I mean?
That's
like, I'd be like, yeah, Derek Jeter's a good shortstop. And then you could be like, well, actually, look at his field, right? And, and I don't know. So it's almost like I'm just following a script now of what I'm supposed to think according to these numbers.
I think it's like, I mean, I know what you mean, but like,
you know what I mean?
When I watch baseball games, I don't watch them through, I don't like follow GameCast. Like, I'd rather go to a game live and eat a hot dog than, you know what I mean? Like, so I think it's like, I think it is useful. It's more useful to you, to a person, as a way to like learn more about the game you already love than it is to like teach something. Like, I have a 13-month-old son, and when I teach him about baseball, I'm not going to like say, like, the first thing you need to know is VORP. You know, like, I'm going to like take him to Fenway 100 times, and I'm going to talk about it's what this is, what a double play is, and this is why that guy just did something smart by hustling to first or whatever.
Yeah.
And then it's like a thing that you eventually will use to supplement and learn more about and stuff. And like, Nothing replaces just watching baseball. Like, just watching baseball is the most fun thing to do.
I hope you're right. Like, you even look at, like, what David Price did in Game 7 last year.
Yeah.
You know, you look at the box score, and it doesn't do it justice of this guy coming in. He's basically, they're going to sink or swim with this guy. Yeah, they're going to sink or swim with this guy who is in single A. And he came through. There's no stat to quantify what happened there, you know?
No, absolutely not. And there's also there's no stats really to replace, like, how like amazing it is when something incredibly fluky and lucky happens. Like, you know, that's like Jeter's reputation essentially boils down to the play he made against the A's when he took the errant cutoff throw from right and flipped it to Posada and tagged out Giambi at the plate, who inexplicably didn't slide. And like that's people are right when they say there's no statistic that you can cite to show like why that was a great play. Now, if you're super ornery like I am, you might also say, like, what the hell is Derek Jeter doing, like, wandering around the pitcher's mound? He should have been covering a base.
Right.
But the fact is, like, the guy's a great baseball player, and he made a great play. Like, the normal course of a baseball play had totally broken down, and that guy just ran over and grabbed the ball like you're taught in Little League and flipped it crazily, perfectly to his catcher and tagged out the tying or whatever it was, the tying or go-ahead run. And, of course, yes, there's absolutely no statistic to point out how great a play that is, and that's why it's fun to watch baseball. And it's like I've never thought of the statistical revolution as something that replaces it. It's just like it's something that you can add to it. When someone cites that play Jeter made and says, that's why Derek Jeter is the single greatest baseball player who's ever existed in the 20th century, you say, oh, no, you're wrong.
Right.
And here's the proof, you know?
Yeah, I think I'm kind of in the middle because I like the stat thing. And I was on board pretty early. First when I was playing whatifsports.com and just kind of realizing through trial and error that, oh yeah, if I have guys with good OBP and good whip and stuff like, you know, unconventional things, my team is going to do better.
Yeah.
And as that was happening, Moneyball came out and it just seemed like this thing that was evolving. And
yeah.
Once you get in a VORP and Pacoda, if you have stats that take like more than a minute to explain, I'm not totally down with it. I feel like it should be one sentence. You know, whip is pretty easy.
Yeah.
Once you get to VORP, it's like, all right, we're getting a little complicated here. A tiny bit.
No, it is. And it's like, but what I like is that they exist and that people are trying to find them. You know what I mean? I just think it's good I think it's just a good sign that there are people who are like, hey, I'm gonna do this new thing and see if this helps explain the world. Like, that's how Bill James writes.
Right.
Sometimes when you read his writing, he's like, why am I doing this? I don't know. It seems like it works. Like, this is my formula. And when you test my formula against the people who you think of as great players, it seems like it pretty much lines up. So I think it's a good formula. Like, it's not just a bunch of dudes in the Institute for Advanced Science at Princeton or something who are totally removed from the world. Like, the people who are doing it are trying to apply it and trying to, like, look at baseball games and baseball players and see if it makes sense.
The thing I like most about Bill James was that he always had a sense of humor and a self-awareness that I think some of the newer guys lack.
Yeah, I
agree. Some of the newer guys are like, this is the formula, and it works, and you're an idiot. You know, I mean, they're not coming out and saying that, but there's a condescension
to
the writing that I don't think Bill James – I always thought he had a sense of humor about himself.
No, same with Joe Posnanski, who I love.
Yep.
I don't know if you read him, but he has the same exact kind of thing. And it's funny because, like – yes, there are certainly people, myself included, who have indulged in the condescension thing. I try to do it for humor, at least. But what's funny is that the people who completely hate statistics and thinks that anyone who uses anything other than wins or home runs or something or batting average is a total nerd, those people tend to be more condescending than the people who are using stats, which always makes me laugh because it's like you can't be condescending if you're bragging about how ignorant you are. You know, like if you're talking like very happily about how you never read anything and don't try to learn anything, that's not a position from which someone should be condescending, in my opinion.
Well, especially in baseball, where again, this is the one sport where it's an individual sport and you can really learn things from this stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I will say though, back to the whole stats versus the experience of watching, the thing I love personally most about baseball is that this is my team, and they're on every day for 6.5 months or however long.
It's wonderful.
However long
isn't it?
It is. Yeah, and it's just, day in and day out, and you get to know the guys. And this is, you know, the one of the things I loved about Manny was that this was a guy who was in my life for 8 solid years, and yep. It got to the point where I knew when he was in a cold streak. I knew that it was as soon as there's something would happen with his swing, and I knew it, and I knew he was going to be in trouble for a couple weeks. I knew when he was getting hot. I knew when he was locked in. I knew when he was happy. Like, yeah. These people become like, it's weird, but I guess not friends, but more family members. They're part of your life.
They are absolutely part of your life, and you are, I remember, I think it was the last year, it was the year Nomar, it must have been 2004, maybe.
Yeah.
When Nomar was traded, but he went, it was either that year or the year before, he went down with an injury and Pokey Reese was stepping in like April and May. And, he was like, you know, Pokey Reese wasn't a great baseball player, but he was like kind of, he was like working so hard and he was making great defensive plays. And I was really coming to like appreciate him and like watching him for 3 hours a night. And then there was that game at Fenway where he hit 2 home runs. Do you remember this? He hit home run. And I had a feeling of pride. That it was like my child had just performed at like a piano recital and done really well. You know, you come to this moment where you're like, I've been following your career, and now you've just triumphed in a game against the A's in May. And
I remember
happy for you.
When they first brought up Papelbon, and it was a Sunday game, I don't remember what month, but, you know, random guy, you hear good things about him, live fastball, that stuff, but you don't know it till you see it. And he comes in, I forget what happened, our closer might have been, you know, pitch consecutive days or whatever happened. And he ended up actually having to get some outs with a sold-out Fenway crowd against a good team.
Yeah.
And he came through. And not only did he come through, but there was something about him that I liked.
Yeah.
And I just remember thinking, ooh, you know, we got something with this guy. This something's going to happen with this guy.
Yeah.
That,
well,
that's another baseball thing, you know?
Yeah. I the first time when he first came up, I think his first game was they started him. And
right.
I was Seth Myers, who's my best friend essentially, was out here, and I went over to his house, and he and his brother Josh were watching the game at his house, and I made makeshift Papelbon jerseys for everybody. I just took white T-shirts and I wrote Papelbon on the back, and then I wrote a uniform. I wrote the uniform number 200, as a joke, because I was like, I don't know what number they're going to give him. I'm going to guess 200, and we sat there wearing these crappy makeshift Papelbon jerseys, and. Yeah, like you're saying, you hear good things about him, you read about him in the minors, and then he just started blowing guys away, and it's literally like the feeling is you've made a new friend.
Yeah,
you know, it's like this guy. Hopefully, this guy will be in my life for 8 more years, like Manny was. You know,
and that's another thing that I love about baseball is you can even remember. It's almost like having a first date with somebody. Like I remember when they brought Kevin Morton up. And he started, and I'm like, Kevin Morton, this guy, oh, man. And then you watch him, and you think,
it's not going to work out.
This is not, maybe. Yeah, and we've had 10 guys like that. So you always remember you kind of forget those guys, and you always remember the guys that.
That was Wilton Veras for me.
Yeah. That was
I love that guy. He wears his socks really high.
Or then you had, like, the Phil Plantier type who had, like, the 130 at-bat sample and was amazing. And then you're just holding on, hope, waiting for it to turn around for 2 years, and it never does. Do you feel like being on the West Coast, like with the Manny thing last year, for instance, that we have a better perspective on the Red Sox or a worse perspective? Because we're not caught into the whole people arguing about it at bars or people, you know, WEI talking about it constantly, and we're not. We can kind of look at it a little more objectively because we're a little more distanced.
It's a good question. It's a very good question. I think of the Red Sox a little bit the way I think about drinking alcohol. I don't know if this analogy makes sense, but I lived on the East Coast all my life. I lived in Connecticut and then Boston, then New York, and in my like teens and 20s. I got drunk on the Red Sox every day of my life, like off season, on season, whatever. And then when I was 28, I moved out to LA to be with my then girlfriend, now wife. And at the same exact moment that I was like, it was after 2004 basically, where I was like, God, you know, I used to be able to go out and like have 4 or 5 beers or a couple glasses of whiskey and be okay. And now I can't. Like I'm wrecked the next day. The same became true about the Red Sox. And I actually, even though I watched all the games, I still read about them. I felt like if I were still indulging in the Red Sox as much and as intensely as I was in my 20s, I think I would die. You know, so I actually appreciate the distance a little bit. Like, I get to follow them as closely as I want, but like the games are on at 4. You know, it's like a gentle breeze instead of a like thing that ruins every night of your life because you can't leave your house from 7 to 10:30.
And yeah, I remember one of the last years in Boston, they played Seattle, and it went like 18 innings.
I remember
staying
that.
Up till like 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning, whatever it was. It just
didn't. I think like Mike Cameron won that game for the Mariners with a home run in the 18th or something.
Yeah, yeah. It just like being a mess for 3 days afterwards.
Yeah, just awful. And I like being out here. And with the Manny thing, because he came to L.A., I still felt like I was part of the discussion or something. You know, like
yeah, it was
still,
funny.
Yeah.
It was funny how that worked out, considering how many Red Sox transplants live here.
I know.
And then to have Manny, of all places, come here.
Did you
and then
go
to just become a hero.
Did you go to any of the games when he came out here?
I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And it's going to be really tough for me. It's really tough for me to go to a game where everybody's happy for him, but he's not wearing the uniform. I don't know.
Yeah.
I took this Manny thing really personally.
I went to one of the games after he got traded, and the number of people, I mean, first of all, it was exciting because LA doesn't really care about the Dodgers. Like,
no,
I mean, some parts of LA do, but they don't really. And suddenly everybody in LA cared about the Dodgers. And it actually reminded me of being in New York in like 99 when everyone, even like people had no interest in baseball, were so caught up in the Yankees because they were just winning.
And the Mets, the Mets the next year. But
the Mets
New York
next
became
year.
Very baseball-centric.
Yeah, and suddenly there were people, like you would go into a bar or a restaurant in L.A. and the Dodgers game would be on. You'd be like, what the hell is the Dodgers game doing on TV? And people were, like, interested in it because the guy was hitting .500 for, like, 2 months. And it was cool. Like, it made me happy that if he had to leave the Red Sox, at least he went to a place where he was sort of energizing a city, you know?
Yeah, I'm torn on the distance thing. Like, there's a lot of things I like about not being smack dab in the middle of it and the games coming on and just being able to enjoy it and not have it be life or death all the time. But on the other hand, you know, there's nothing like being there in September.
Oh, no.
When just walking around downtown and everybody's got a hat on or a jersey on and, like, the Yankees are in. I wrote about this once. Like, you really feel like the whole city is about to go to war. The Yankees are in town. It's September. We're all on the same page. There isn't a person walking around downtown who doesn't know that the Red Sox are playing the Yankees that night.
Yeah.
And that's the type of thing you just can't get, you know, really in almost any city, but especially out here, you know.
No, absolutely not out here. And there, in the times that I've gone back to Fenway since I moved, I've had, like, immediate remorse of, like, why am I not just living here? Why am I not? Why don't I have a small apartment in Kenmore Square?
I know. I feel the same way. It's on the other hand, it's nice to go back. And I think I appreciate it more when I go back. When I go back and it's a big weekend or there's a big game or something, like, it's really special to me. And it's like, this is what I grew up with. And this is what I was here when I lived here for 10 years. And,
You know,
I just don't think there's a lot of cities. I'm sure Philly's like that. I don't want to say we're the only city. I'm sure Chicago.
No, not at all.
Chicago, I'm sure, is like that, but it is a unique thing.
Yeah.
So anyway, back to my original question.
Which was?
So they trade for Miguel Cabrera. They basically pillage the Tigers. They pillage them. They leave them just there, a smoking corpse. How fast do you talk yourself into it?
Into being okay with it?
Yeah.
Oh, I'd be fine with it. I'm not, like, the guy's great. He's 25. I mean, I would be fine with it. But, you know.
Me too.
I think that, like.
I'm glad you said it.
I mean, they're the Red Sox. You want your favorite team to win, regardless of who it is. But.
Yes.
I am a total, I've completely bought into the management. Like, I don't think they're blameless or flawless or anything, but I just think they're really smart, and I think they always do what's best for the team at some level. Even, I mean, the Manny thing is its own thing, but in terms of the guys they trade for, the guys they develop, I just think they're so good at what they do. I think as a fan of the team, they're like the best management and owner you could ever hope for. And I guarantee the great thing about it is, like, and this hasn't been true in previous administrations, I guarantee that if that's possible, they'll look into it. You know, that's all you ever want from the people who run your team. You just want them to leave no stone unturned, and you want them to say, like, yeah, I'll bet Miguel Cabrera is untouchable, but we're going to call and find out.
Yeah, you know, you would have enjoyed this conference I went to a couple weeks ago at MIT where they had all these different executives, and it was basically a statistical conference, but one of the main themes that kept coming up was that these new wave teams, the teams from this decade, they're up for anything that might help them win. And they don't care if it works out or not, but if somebody tells them, hey, I have this new statistical model that might be able to measure adjusted plus minus, but it'll cost this much, they're like, go for it. One of the Celtics guys was there, Mike Zarin, who's their head stat guy, and he was talking about Danny Ainge. Danny Ainge will try anything.
Yeah.
Because he'll figure, like, maybe 8 out of 10 times it's stupid and it doesn't work, but maybe that, you know, that ninth time.
Yeah.
You might really have something. And I think you're right. Like, the Red Sox, they've been in that mode really from the get-go, but it also seems like more teams are shifting in that direction. Teams are getting smarter. And it doesn't go for every team, as we just saw that the Clippers might bring in Isaiah Thomas. There's some franchises that would just never get smarter. But for the most part, it seems like the teams that have money and smart owners are going in that direction. And
well, let me ask you this, because you know more about the NBA than I know about anything. And I'm not a huge NBA guy. I'm a Celtics fan, but I don't follow the NBA super closely. But did you read the Michael Lewis article about Shane Battier that was in the New York Times I don't know, a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago?
I did, and I loved it. And actually, I wrote this magazine column that ran this issue about the conference I went to, and I referenced that article, but I guess they cut it for space or something. But
oh, okay.
It was kind of disappointing that they didn't they cut that out, because I kind of felt like my column was playing off the Lewis thing.
Oh,
but
right.
Yeah, I thought the Lewis thing, first of all, anything he writes, he's just, you know,
fantastic. Yeah.
Technically, he's just perfect. He's like Michael Jordan of nonfiction writers. I almost like feel bad about myself when I read him. I'm just like, oh my God. But yeah, it was very interesting. And I guess the big difference in basketball and baseball is that in baseball, you can figure this stuff out. And in basketball, there's always going to be a level of subjectivity to it.
Well, the reason I bring it up is really to ask you, like, as a guy who follows the NBA that closely, as closely as you do, like, did you have that feeling about Shane Battier? Was he a guy that you had watched play and said, like, there's something about that guy? Or was that a revelation to you?
No. In fact, on my old website, which I think you read, or at least checked out once upon a time.
Yeah.
I had a whole thing about Shane Battier. How it wasn't a whole column. It was a piece of, like, a five-part column, but it was about how I thought he should have been the first pick in that draft, whatever draft it was. Yeah, but just because I thought the stuff he did, and he was doing stuff that people couldn't. It's kind of weird to read in retrospect, but he's just one of those guys that does stuff. I always judge basketball players by who would I want to play with, and he's somebody that nobody's going to be like, man, I hate having Shane Battier as a teammate. He's so unselfish. And so all he wants to do is guard the other team's best guy, and he tries so hard. Who wants to?
Yeah.
You know, so the difference with baseball, I think, is that I really just don't think that guys can make other guys better. I know we like to pretend that, oh, yeah, there are 25 guys on the same page. And, like, we grew up with the Red Sox of the late 70s. You always heard 25 guys, 25 cabs,
yeah.
But ultimately, I think that's all crap. You know, if Lou Piniella misses the line drive in a right field in a 7-day playoff game, we probably win the World Series that year.
Right.
With 25 players, 25 caps. So.
Right. And every time, I mean, so much of that stuff is applied retroactively, where, like, if things go wrong, like with the Mets in the last couple of years, like, you just apply, people just apply retroactively, like, well, you know, the problem was they had no clubhouse chemistry. And it's like, no, the problem was they lost a bunch of games at the end of the year. They had injuries and some things didn't break their way. Like, it's just, I feel like it's like people ascribe to good teams or bad teams certain qualities that they think match up with how that team performed. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and anybody who believes in baseball chemistry really needs to go on eBay and get a copy of The Bronx Zoo by Sparky Lyle. Read the Reggie Jackson stories and remember that they won that year.
Yeah.
And then they won the next year.
Yep.
So, yeah, I really just, you know.
I mean, I'm sure that good chemistry makes it more fun to play. And, like, I'm sure that, like, if everybody in the clubhouse is really tight and everything, that, like, it's more fun to come to the ballpark and you might be in a better mood and stuff. But ultimately, like, these guys are trained killers. Like, they go out and they play baseball as hard as they can, most of them at least. And it's an individual, like you said. It's like there are certain things where you can help your teammates, but, like, essentially it comes down to batter and pitcher, you know?
And really, Freddie, this can't be emphasized strongly enough. Baseball players are the dumbest athletes on the planet. And they really are. People, for some reason, think that football players are dumber, but football players have to memorize plays and stuff. In baseball, yeah. All you have to do is hit a ball or catch it or throw it. And these guys are getting pulled out of high school for the most part. And then they go through this minor league system where you're just basically trying to get laid for 5 years and then show up for the games. Those are your two goals. And then these guys all end up on a team professionally making too much money.
Yeah.
So they're not sitting in there talking about Michael Lewis's Shane Battier article. They're talking about, is that girl in the third row wearing underwear or not? Let's talk TV really quick.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you're in TV. You do
I
stuff.
Am. Yeah.
You were on SNL.
Yeah, I started SNL in 98, January of 98, and I was there for 6.5 years.
As a writer?
As a writer, and then for the last three years, I also produced a Weekend Update when it was Tina Fey and Jimmy Fallon.
Nice.
Yeah, that was fun.
It was a good stretch.
It was a good stretch. Thank you.
So
I know
then
you're a pretty intense fan of the show. You have a lot of historical knowledge about the different eras, right?
Yeah, and it's to the point that it's probably a little weird. It's a little tiny bit strange, right? Like I had Bill Hader on the podcast yesterday, and he brought up. Actually, it was before we went on. We were talking about when Bill Murray and Chevy Chase had their fist fight before a show. And I knew too much about it. Kind of scared myself. It's like, all right, maybe I should put down the three SNL books or whatever. But, it's a show that it came on when I was six.
Right.
And I can't remember any point of my life without SNL. I don't remember really anything before I was six.
Yeah.
And it was a show that as soon as I was old enough to watch, I was able to watch.
Right.
Which was probably, Bill Murray's first big season. But then that same year, I don't know if you remember, but they were showing, or maybe it was a little bit later, but at some point, late 70s, early 80s, they started showing the condensed. Oh, it was late 70s. NBC started showing the old SNLs condensed to an hour in prime time. And that's how I caught up on all the old seasons. Such a cool show.
Yeah, it's the best first job you could ever have. I mean, I think most of the people who work there, it's their first big job. Mm-hmm. And that's why everyone is happy to put in the hours that you have to put in. And that's why you have this kind of weird feeling of like camaraderie amongst like everyone who's ever worked there. Like if you run into someone who worked there, you could trade stories for 2 hours, happily.
Right.
Because it's a unique thing, and it's something that, it's a real, gauntlet that everybody has to go through.
But at the same time, it's a means to an end, because all the stories about this guy wrote all the Adam Sandler movies, and this guy wrote the Will Ferrell movies, and this
guy
did this.
Yeah, I guess it is, although I got to say that when I was working there, I don't think people think of it that way. I mean, obviously everybody wants to have a long career and do different things, but when you're there, you're so focused on the show. I mean, it's like every week you start with nothing, and you have to put on a 90-minute show at the end of the week. And you're so focused on that just week in and week out, and it's so exhausting, and it takes up so much of your time that, people don't sit around and dream about what their next move is a lot. I mean, I get everybody's different, but that I never really thought of it that way. I was so happy to be there. And I felt so lucky to have that job, and I enjoyed it so much that I never really, it wasn't until, the only reason I left really was because my girlfriend, who's now my wife, had moved out here to write on a show out here, and we were dating long distance for like a year, and it was just killing me. And so I had been there for 6.5 or 7 years or whatever it was, and just decided it was time to go chase her down to make an honest woman out of her.
Really? So this is like almost a romantic comedy. It's like a Drew Barrymore movie.
It is. It's a really boring romantic comedy.
It's a romantic comedy with no
no twists.
What do they call it at like the 120 mark where something bad happens and they might break up?
The
crisis usually, point or whatever.
The second act break or the crisis point. Yeah, whatever. Yeah. The low point. Yeah.
So they're talking to doing The Office.
Well, I decided to try to get a job out here. And I interviewed at a bunch of places, and the only place that offered me a job was The Office. Greg Daniels, who adapted The Office, read this sample script that I had written and offered me a job. And it was the job I wanted the most because I was such a fan of the British show.
Mm-hmm.
And I met with him, and we talked for like 2 hours in his office, and it was love at first sight.
Did you have any idea it was going to be as big as it ended up getting?
Oh, no, no, nobody did. I mean, we all felt like, you know, if we can honor the, at the beginning, we sort of felt like if we could honor the British show and just do quality episodes, then we will have done our job. I think that was the main thing. And everyone loved Carell. Like, everybody knew Carell and loved Carell and thought he was amazing. And then when I watched the pilot that they had shot, I was like, hey, these other guys are really good too. Like, they found like really good, interesting people to play his other parts. And so, but no one ever imagined that it would. I remember there was a moment where Steve and the rest of the cast was sort of hanging out outside the studio while we were shooting the last episode. I wasn't in the conversation, but I kind of overheard them talking. And Steve was sort of looking around to them, and he said something like, you know what? We made 6 really funny episodes, I think, you know? And we got 6, and this was really fun, and I'm so happy I got to work with you guys. And this was, like, really great. And they were all sort of saying, like, yeah, and that, the mood was like, we had the chance to do 6 episodes, and then we should be really grateful for that. Which was, I think, the way everyone really felt. And then...
That's probably the way to think, though.
What's that?
I mean, that's the way to think. Just, hey,
yeah,
bang
totally
out some good stuff.
Yeah.
Let's see what happens.
Yeah, and then, you know, we got very, very lucky because, I mean, I think the episodes were good, but also Kevin Reilly was running NBC at the time, and he was a big fan of the show, and Steve did the 40-Year-Old Virgin that came out that summer.
Nice timing. So
the show was a little bit on the bubble, and then that suddenly was like, oh, wait, we've got a movie star under contract for 6 years. We should probably keep him around and give him a chance to grow his show. And then it sort of took off from there. Like, you know, it was very, very fortunate and also the result of a lot of incredibly hard work from a lot of talented people.
But then you have that balance, though, where you become a show. Like, it starts out like you're kind of cool. You're like, oh, man, you've seen do you remember this club if you like The Office? But then things keep evolving, and then it just becomes a big show, and you're not really breaking any ground by saying, one of my favorite shows is The Office. It's one of those things where...
Yeah.
So you reach this point, but then to stay up there after that point, I think, is really good. I mean, that's your ultimate goal as a creative person, to survive all that backlash and stay up there, you know?
The world is a very... the entertainment world is a very rough and tumble place in terms of the way that people, like... experience their entertainment. Like, people are very, very quick. If you try to force anything on anybody and try to, like, shove it down their throats, they reject it immediately. Like, the public has become extremely savvy. And also, like, they're everyone's always looking for, like, the next interesting, cool thing. So, I mean, I haven't worked on The Office for a year, really, because I've been working on this new show. But it's very, like... I think it's must be very rewarding for the people who are still putting that show out every week that, like, it's still well received and people still seem to like it a lot after, you know, almost 100 episodes now. They're closing in on 100 episododes, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, there should be some sort of, it's kind of like the tipping point, but there should be a better word for it when a show reaches a point where it's almost a no-win situation. And at that point, that's when you really know, are you going to have the legs or not? Like, for instance, Heroes.
Yeah.
Awesome first season. People turn on that show so fast.
Yeah.
There's such a sense of entitlement. And, you know, it just was getting crushed with the message boards. And then, and I think this happened with Lost a little bit too, where it seems like the people who run the shows almost like pay attention to the message boards. Do you really want to pay attention to message boards?
I know. Well, genre shows or sci-fi shows like Heroes and Lost have it even tougher, I think, if that's possible, than comedies, because the fans are so, so revved up for those shows, and they get so involved, and they're so intense. And my wife actually wrote for Heroes, and I watched it happen through her eyes, and
yeah. And
it was the people were sort of feeling like, you know, God, we're trying, you know, like I think they think that they're making good shows and they're trying to introduce new characters, but like for whatever reason, people just turned on it a little bit, and the ratings started to slip, and Lost, the crazy thing about Lost is that they got it back. Like, they took a dip in that season 2 or whatever it was.
Yeah,
and then they came up with a way to, like, reinvent the show and sort of breathe new life into it. And that's a really rare thing. Like, usually once you start slipping down that slope, you don't really have a chance to scamper back up. But they did it somehow. It was very impressive.
When you guys were doing The Office, or at least when you were there, did you guys pay attention to the message boards, blogs, and that stuff, or not really?
Well, we tried not to, but... I don't know if you have this feeling from writing your column, but it's so hard when you know that there are people all over the country who are writing about you.
Right.
It's so hard not to read it. So we tried as hard as we could not to, but, you know, when we would read stuff that people were writing about the show, oftentimes it helped us, I think. Like, you know, people would say, you know, I thought that moment was creepy because X, Y, and Z or whatever. And it would at least make you, like, reevaluate it and look at it and say, like, oh, we weren't going for that. Maybe we missed something. And I don't think that we really changed anything or altered anything in any significant way from reaction on the internet. But as hard as we tried not to read it, we would end up reading it sometimes. You just can't. It's like you're standing outside a giant auditorium and there's a symposium going on about you. And it's like, do you want to go inside? It's like, how do you not open that door and look in and peek in and hear what people are saying about you? It's just very hard to resist that temptation.
It's funny. I don't look at it.
Oh, really?
Because I think it can, you know, I think it's different for a writer because writers just naturally, I mean, writers who are writing, they're by themselves writing and they're in charge of it. Like, I just think it's too easy to have your confidence get shaken. You know what I mean?
I
think if you're in a more collaborative thing, it's, you know, you're going to have more confidence.
I've made it my life's work in the last couple of years never to look at the internet if I can possibly do it.
It's a good idea not to.
It will shake your confidence. There's no way around it. Like doesn't matter what you do. It doesn't matter who you are. You're De Niro. You're Will Ferrell. Or whoever you are. Like there is a large group of people out there who doesn't like you, and the people who don't like you tend to be the ones who post things on message boards and write about you. So
or are more prone to being on message boards. Yeah, I'm not against it. It's just I think the more of a profile that you have, it's just going to be impossible for everybody to like you.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's just I remember you know, we were growing up in the 70s. They would do those polls every year, the most liked media member and the least liked most media member.
Right.
And Howard Cosell would somehow win both. And it would be like, this guy's the most liked and the least liked? How's it possible? But
I think that's good, though. I think that he would have enjoyed that, I'm imagining. You know,
no question.
It means if a lot of people like you strongly and a lot of people dislike you strongly, it means that you have some kind of You're not just like playing to the middle. You're trying something in, you know, individualistic or something, and some people like you and some people don't. I think that's the best case scenario. If you can get a large group of people to really devotedly like you and a large group of people to dislike you, I think that means you're doing something interesting.
Yeah, my goal is for people to like me and for nobody to not like me to the point where I'd get like shot at a book signing. If I can find that balance, I'm good.
That's a perfect way to look at it. Like, you, I'll take the edge off of the high and the low if it means I won't get shot at.
Yeah, somebody sitting outside my house at 1 a.m. smoking a cigarette and just and he's there because he hates my column, then I've done something wrong. Let's talk about your new show really quick because I know you have to go. Parks and Recreation, Amy Poehler.
Yes.
When is it premiere?
April 9th at 8:30. There's
8:30 what day?
8:30 Thursday, April 9th.
Ooh, nice time slot.
It's sandwiched. There's a delicious comedy sandwich where they're doing two new Office episodes, one at 8 and one at 9, and we're stuck in the middle of the sandwich. So
nice.
Hopefully that'll help us.
Nice to be in an Office sandwich.
It's an Office sandwich. Yeah, it's not bad. It's a good place to be. And it's Amy Poehler. And Aziz Ansari, I don't know if you know him, but he's a super funny guy. He was in this sketch called Human Giant that was really funny with Rob Hubel and Paul Scheer.
Oh, yeah, I remember
that. And Rashida Jones is in it, who was on The Office for a year, and Aubrey Plaza, who's a young comedian who's super funny, and it's a great cast. And it's about a bunch of people who work in a parks and rec department and a government in a medium-sized town in Indiana.
What was the original title?
There's one that got leaked, which we don't know how it got leaked, but the one that got leaked was Public Service, which was something we were kicking around for a while, but we didn't settle officially on anything until we settled on Parks and Recreation, so.
What were the other potential titles?
There was Public Service, there was Public
What was your
Service.
Personal favorite? You must have had a personal favorite.
My personal favorite was always Parks and Recreation, to be honest. There's something I just like about how, I think, you know, when you were growing up, I don't know, if you had this experience, but when I was growing up, like, I would always see posters all around my town in Connecticut for, like, the Department of Parks and Recreation presents,
right.
You know, 4th of July fireworks or free hot dogs in the park. I went to day camp in a park behind my house, you know, and then I was a counselor at that camp. And it's very, like, to me, the words Parks and Recreation are very evocative of a certain kind of, like, fun, like summer activities fair kind of thing, you know?
Well, it also passes the whole title test, which I always apply, where it sounds simplistic and it sounds stupid, but you really kind of want to know what the show's about in the title, and you want to express that as simply as possible.
Right.
It's like The Office is about an office.
The Office is about an office. That was the thing that was ultimately the reason we settled on this, was it was like, if you were, the show is a mock documentary, and we always thought, like, well, if it were a real documentary, what would the people making the documentary call it? And it's like, well, they'd call it Parks and Recreation. That's what it's about, you know, so.
You know what I think the greatest TV show title ever was?
What's that?
Cheers.
Yeah, exactly.
If you really analyze Cheers, it's like, that's an awesome title. It's happy.
Yeah.
It insinuates that it's in a bar and people are toasting, but it's not, you know, implicit.
Yeah,
it's just
and also the word means happy.
Yeah,
you know,
it's a nice one.
It's like you're getting the sense that if you watch this show, you'll be happy.
I picture the guys. I forget who did that show, but they're all in a room trying to figure out the title, and somebody came up with that, and all of them were like, "That's it,
oh,
perfect,
yeah, of course. Yeah, absolutely.
Done and done."
I think the best title for a TV show is Manimal.
See, that passes my test, though.
You know what it's about, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, even you look at, like, the great action movies and, you know, The Fugitive. It's about a fugitive.
Yeah.
Die Hard.
Yeah.
The guy doesn't want to die.
Yeah.
It's Fatal Attraction. She's crazy. He was attracted to her and it became fatal. Yeah.
Yeah. Star Wars. They're fighting in space.
So how many shows did you have to do for this season?
We're doing 6 episodes for this little mini season. And we're about to start shooting number 4 on Monday. And, then we had to delay our schedule a little bit. It was going to be 13, and then we had to delay because when we decided to delayed our production to get Amy Poehler, basically, because she was pregnant. We were supposed to start shooting right at the time she was going to deliver her baby. So we delayed by 3 months and cut the order down to 6 episodes.
Ultimately this is like The Office in that you want the great ensemble cast, but the show is, you know, it really depends on the star. It's like basketball.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's like, I mean, Amy, in my opinion, is like a 1 in a billion comedic performer. And so the show is built around her, but all the other, hopefully people come to like all the other characters and find them funny too, in the same way that they found, you know, Jim and Pam and Dwight and all those people in The Office funny. So
I always have the overqualified test where she's probably almost overqualified to have her own TV show. You know what I mean? Like, she should really be doing movies. And, like, when Clooney was on ER that year,
yeah,
it was like when you have, like, a football team has the offensive coordinator that, you know, should be a head coach.
Right.
He's almost like, it's almost beneath him to do this job. And I feel that way with her. Like, she could just be a movie star, but she's going to, you know, nail this TV show, I feel like.
I hope so, yeah. I mean, I totally agree with you. I think she could have walked into movies. I mean, there's a certain appeal for comics, I think, to do TV because they get to play one character over many years, which I think is kind of more interesting than just playing it for 2 hours. But she's just phenomenal. She's just so good. And I think she's funny in this show in a way that, like, people haven't seen her be funny on SNL. Like, she does a lot of big, funny, you know, broad comedy things like she did in the sketches and stuff. But she's also just a really subtle, quiet performer. So this show is kind of highlighting, like, her entire range from very small to very big and juicy and funny.
Well, good luck.
Yeah, thanks, man.
This is, I mean, I. So that show is what? It's April 9th, right?
April 9th.
Opening day is April 6th.
April 6th, that's right.
I'm going to say that's a big week for you.
It would be, you know what? It would be a big week for me if just only one of those things were true. But with both of them, it makes it a huge week.
All right. Well, good luck. And I'd love to have you on again during baseball season. You're going to come back on. Don't get too busy.
Anytime. This is a true honor for me to do the Bill Simmons podcast.
Thank you. All right. Well, I'll be back. Talk Red Sox. Good luck with the premiere.
All right, man. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Hello, John O'Connell.
Johnny.
Hey. What's going on, man?
Sneak attack.
It is a sneak attack. Caught off guard. Sometimes I get a little bit of a heads up.
Well, hey, listen.
Sorry to spoil all the listeners out there, you know, showing how the magic is made.
I have very few BS report rules, but this is one of them. When the UConn men's basketball program is going down in the toilet during an NCAA tournament, I have to call their number one anti-fan, Mr. Jack O.
Is that, was a happy day yesterday. It was almost like I won a championship.
How did you? Did you cut down a net?
I did. It's draped around my neck as we speak.
Holy mackerel.
Yeah, it was a long night of celebrating last night. I was happy. I just kept reading the internet story over and over again.
Do you think this is why, was this why he was dehydrated last week? Dehydrated?
Well, sending 1,500 texts a month or whatever is going to take a lot out of a guy, you know? So all that thumb action is really going to make you a little tired. Yeah, understandably.
Is there an anti-Calhoun, like, blogger out there who's just listed all the shady stuff that has happened with this program very secretly and nobody in Connecticut, everyone in Connecticut's in denial about it?
Sadly, there is no one source like that, although this is a good chance for someone to become the Woodward and Bernstein of the blog age and start such a blog. But I was reading the article yesterday in our own Hartford Current, of course, a day late, $5 short in the story, of course.
Yeah.
God forbid they should uncover the thing happening right under their very nose, but they were too busy writing wonderful, glowing stories about all the wonderful charity work that Jim Calhoun's done in the state, apparently. And I was reading it online, and they had all these comments, and I was surprised by some of the people that came out from the woodwork and had opinions similar to mine and shared their vitriol at the UConn basketball program.
Right.
And they listed a lot of people that I forgot about, like this guy, Terrano Walker, who was a UConn player who's now serving like the rest of his life or some period of time in jail because he was involved in criminal activity and basically was like shunned by the UConn program. And I'd completely forgotten about this guy, Nate Miles, and how he was at school for about 5 minutes when he – you know, essentially tried to force himself on a woman who filed understandable complaints, and then he got a restraining order and literally violated it 16 minutes after it was entered by the court by calling her. I mean, he's really one of the greats, this guy.
was that an alleged assault, or he was actually convicted of it?
Well, no, I mean, it wasn't, it never really came to the assault point, but apparently she claimed that she knew him and
all right. So, in fairness to Nate, we'll say it was an alleged assault.
Yeah, no, I'll take that back. It was not an actual assault, but she felt that he was kind of like threatening her or pressuring her for sex, and you know, it was he said, she said, but the court sided with her because they issued a restraining order for him to stay away,
right?
And that which he violated in 16 minutes. Honest to God, 16 minutes after it entered, he called her up. It was like, come on, baby, don't put a restraining order or whatever he said, you know?
Yeah.
And he got expelled from the school. But interestingly, that article, there was many interesting things, obviously, but UConn, the coaches, unperturbed by the fact that he was expelled from the school, continued to recruit him for next season's team.
Seriously?
Yeah, that's what it said at the end of the article online about the allegations coming out.
Wow.
That they were still recruiting him. I don't know how they would have sold that to the public. Of course, the public eats everything up that Calhoun says, so they'd have gone with it swimmingly. But
well, what was the laptop thing? Refresh my memory with that one.
AJ Price. I forgot if he stole him. I don't think he stole him when he was in high school. I forgot if it was from UConn itself. I think it was from UConn. He and some other guy on the team were involved in, I think another guy on the team, yeah, were involved in stealing laptops. I forget, from like a dorm or a computer lab, and then attempting to sell them.
Right.
The other guy, they bounced from the team, but he wasn't as good. He was sort of not quite a walk-on, but a negligible player. So him, they were like, thanks for coming. Good luck in future projects. But AJ Price, they completely stuck with the team.
Marcus Williams was the other guy.
That's right. That's right. And he got like a year-long suspension or something, and then I think he eventually left. But AJ Price, they suspended for like a handful of games against Division III schools, but he was right back on the team for the Big East schedule to get started.
Wait a second. So this, I just Googled it. November 15, 2005, he got probation, and it says he was 19.
Mm.
And he's on this year's team. So he's 23?
Yeah, that's probably right. He probably went to, like a prep school or something, you know, in between high school.
And he blew out his knee last year.
Right. So he had the extra eligibility. He was redshirted. So.
Well, that's good. I'm sure AJ's working on his MBA.
He's in the graduate program.
He's got those laptops he could use.
I mean, speaking of, you know, working on his MBA, I saw a thing before the tournament started that of the four number one seeds, UConn has the lowest graduation rate of any of the number four seeds. And you're not talking about, like, Harvard and Yale. I mean, North Carolina is a good school, but and now I'll get some more emails. But, I mean, we're talking University of Pittsburgh and University of Louisville being in the mix there.
And Xavier.
What's that?
Is Xavier a good school?
Well, no, they're just talking about the number one picks.
Oh,
the number one seeds.
I got you.
So you're talking Carolina, Louisville, UConn,
and Pitt.
And Pittsburgh.
Wow.
And UConn was like noticeably lower. They have their graduation rate for scholarship basketball players is 26%. And the NCAA considers graduation if you graduate within 6 years of matriculating from school. Not even 4 years, when most people graduate, 6 years.
And most people, all people.
Right. And UConn could still only manage a 26% in 6 years.
Wow.
Now, I understand that you have your Ray Allens that leave early to go pro, or Richard Hamilton, or Villanueva, Caron Butler, but there's also a lot of guys that don't go pro, that don't ever get their UConn degree. When I made a joke a few weeks ago about the not a dime back thing about UConn being the UNLV of the East, and now it's turned out to be even more true than I suspected.
Now it's insulting the UNLV.
It really is.
Now the UNLV grads are like, come on, man.
Right.
Don't lump us in. We only had a guy in a hot tub.
Right.
With a convicted gambler. Yeah, with a convicted gambler. That was the worst thing we did. You guys are much worse.
Mistakes were made, but that was 15, 20 years ago, so.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. Like, I feel like I should be rooting for UConn because I really like Ray Allen. My mom lives in Connecticut. It's a New England school, ostensibly. But I think you almost have to be from New England to know, like, how over the top the UConn fans are.
Yes.
And especially when you throw in the women's program and Gino Auriemma and all that stuff. It's just one of those schools that's become fun to root against.
Absolutely. And not to mention that the fans and the whole UConn thing in Connecticut is much like the Red Sox, and sorry about that, but much like the pink hat phenomenon of the Red Sox, where everyone's become a Red Sox fan since 2004, but they couldn't spell Yastrzemski. Well, let me tell you, everyone on earth has become a UConn fan since, like, Calhoun got here. But I remember going to games when I was in high school. You could buy tickets for like $5 or $6. My friends and I had season tickets for the Big East package when they played at the Civic Center.
Yeah.
Because you'd go watch them play the Patrick Ewing Georgetown era and St. John's and Syracuse, Villanova, all these great Big East schools at the Civic Center. We would go, and let me tell you, tickets were very available. We would go. We had great seats, and nobody went. So now all these people that are like big UConn boosters here in Connecticut, and it's so over the top would make you sick. It's a joke because they couldn't tell you who the coach was before Calhoun.
How many of them do you think know who Chuck Alexinas was?
About half of a percent.
How about Corny Thompson?
I remember Corny. I remember him from. I remember when they in '79 when they were first in the Big East. That was Corny's big year. He was their big star. But no one who's a UConn fan now knows who that was.
Bruce Kaczynski?
None. Nobody.
I'm on this site that
D. Rowe. D. Rowe was their first great coach, like in the '60s, I believe, in '70s.
That was his name.
And then it was Dom Perno in my formative years. And then when they brought in Calhoun and they hit the big time, they used to be the laughingstock of the Big East or one of them.
So it really turned with the Cliff Robinson Tate George team in what, 1991?
Well, before that, there was a team in like 1989 or 90, I think I want to say, when they won the NIT.
Yeah.
And that was like a big deal. That was like a huge thing because UConn had always been pathetic. And that.
Oh, yeah, 1988 NIT.
They won the NIT, and that was like a huge deal.
Oh, yeah, it's because there's nothing bigger than pulling home that NIT title.
But then when they got like Nadav Henefeld, this guy from Israel.
I remember that.
And he was a huge deal. I remember coming home from college, and one year they went to the Final Eight. I think it was even before it was called the Elite Eight. They just called it the Final Eight.
Yeah.
And I remember going to a bookstore, and I forgot if it was somebody from The Current or somebody wrote some book, and it was called Dream Season, The Road to the Final Eight.
No.
I swear to God, I saw it in the bookstore. And, of course, coming from Connecticut, we used to have the Mighty Whale, and the Whalers were the only team on earth that ever had a victory parade for making the playoffs and getting eliminated in the first round. That their then coach Jack Evans said was a bigger parade than when he was the coach of the Chicago Blackhawks and they won the Stanley Cup.
Right.
So, living in Connecticut, it's like we have a parade when our franchise, our one professional sports franchise, loses in the first round of the playoffs, and then people write books about the dream season, the road to the Final Eight. I mean, you can't make this stuff up.
Well, they won in 1999 and 2004, which means that they're always going to make excuses for him because he won two titles. Kind of like me with Manny Ramirez. I will let myself into it. Manny won me two titles. I'm going to defend him.
Absolutely. And around here, I mean, because we don't have the Mighty Whale anymore, and there is no professional sports team, and yes, I'm not counting the Connecticut Sun, we have no Major League professional sports team, so everyone's going to gravitate towards UConn, and especially because they're a national power. I mean, believe me, I'm only half-joking when I say Calhoun could, like, kill somebody in cold blood on live TV, and people would be like, hey, he's still our coach. He went to championships. Let's not come down too hard on him, you know?
It's kind of what happened when he went after that blogger.
Exactly right. Eric, I mean, the 65% of the public, like, rushed to his defense, if not more, maybe 75%. I was in the distinct minority, and believe me, I heard about it from all my UConn-loving alumni friends. He can do no wrong. I mean, I was just, you know, I tried to say to them, look, I'm not saying he has to give money back, but you can at least admit that from a PR standpoint, given the recession and the budgetary crisis in the state, his answer was not the best. And even they would be like, no, he's fine. Calhoun's great. He put the UConn on the map. He can do whatever he wants. He deserves more money. Oh, okay. My bad.
does he get along with Gino?
Oh, God, no. No, they
really? I didn't know that.
Oh, no, they, like, despise each other.
Why?
They've had, like, a cold war for years. Like, it's written about occasionally about how there was an article in Sports Illustrated a few years ago about it, about how, you know, you think they'd be, like, top of the heap. They'd be getting along with each other. But there's, like, a huge rivalry between the two of them as to who the, no pun intended, the top dog is. Huge. Oh, they despise each other. They barely even speak.
You know what's, so he's feuding with Jim Calhoun and Pat Summitt?
Yeah.
Does anybody get along with Gino or Emma?
I don't believe they really do. No, he's really, I mean, if I had to choose, if it was up to me to be in charge and I got to choose, like, to have only one of them, I would kick him out of the state. He's really, like, just comes across just awfully. Like, in TV interviews, everything.
Gino, you mean?
Yeah, yeah, Gino. He just thinks, like, he is the man. Like, just arrogant, doesn't even begin to describe him.
But, yeah, it's... Let me ask you, how did you feel about Obama? I know we try to stay away from politics, but did you see the Obama press conference with all the press the other day?
I did watch it, actually, yes.
There was like a weird energy to it. I don't know, like the press seemed abnormally close to him. And
close, like leaning in towards him, you mean?
In proximity. I don't know. There's an intimacy that I don't really remember from any of the W press conferences.
Well,
maybe I'm wrong.
They've been pretty close and intimate with him since he first announced his candidacy.
I just set you up. Yeah, damn it. But that, like, the people that he picked.
Yeah.
He was like, let's go to Stars and Stripes.
Yeah.
It's like, what?
Well, it was a big thing after the fact that it was the first time ever, I guess, that a president didn't pick anybody from the Washington Post, the New York Times, or the Wall Street Journal to ask any questions. And yet he picked people from, like, the Politico and from Stars and Stripes and from Ebony Magazine. And from Univision. So he's trying to go in a little bit of a different direction. And, you know, it is 2009, so he's calling, you know, Politico is basically like an internet site, so he's trying to get a little to the new media thing, I guess. So New York Times and the Washington Post, I think, were not pleased. They were like kind of harumphing about it. We're the old media. It's the New York Times, the gray lady.
Last thing, Yanks, Red Sox.
Yeah, how about that? The Yanks with a big win the other day.
How you feeling?
I feel good. A.J. Burnett had 5 1/3 solid innings. And, you know, they have this goofy I actually watched a little bit of that game. And they have this goofy thing where all the Yankees starting pitchers are all buddy-buddy. And they go and watch each other warm up. So when one of them's warming up, the other four ones are, like, standing there and shouting encouragement. And on the broadcast, they said that this is, like, the closest Yankee team in the past 10 years. That the pitchers have started this thing where they all hang out and Nick Swisher's, like, the clubhouse cut up, and it's no more like 25 guys, 25 cabs. Of course, A-Rod's been out of the camp. That may be a factor as well. But, yeah, everybody's, like, loving everybody. So it's good. I like that.
I'm going to say those two events were related.
I think they may well have been. But, yeah, we're happy. We feel good. Yeah, good news out of the Yanks camp. Camp happiness.
Do you think either they're all hanging out and then A-Rod comes back and they're, like, planning some sort of, like, big bowling alley, like, don't tell A-Rod.
Yeah, definitely.
Hey, where you guys go tonight? Think of just hanging in the hotel room, A-Rod.
Yeah, exactly.
I heard you guys talking about somewhere 9:30. No, that was next week. Next week. No, we'll see you later.
You're on the hip.
Yeah, he should probably rest anyway.
It's a distinct possibility, yeah. But it's, yeah, everybody's good. They, yeah, the Yanks looked all right.
Did you watch the WBC, or did you stay away?
No, I stayed away. I was disappointed to see that we did not win, that we were eliminated by Japan, but I can't say as I watched the final game, no. Hmm. I did actually I was hanging out with some friends, and we put it on. We were flipping the channels. We put it on for like a minute. Actually, was that the finals? I don't even know if that was the finals. It was some game with Venezuela involved. Venezuela against Korea. I don't think that was the finals. I think that was like a semifinal. Bobby Abreu, in midseason form, dropped some fly ball. But he's not a Yankee anymore. But he's not crazy about playing the outfield, Bobby is.
Every time I saw Venezuela on TV, I always was getting Ugith Urbina torching his farmhand flashbacks.
Yes.
Like, Venezuela's really got to like put out some sort of statement to distance themselves from...
Did you ever see that E60 that involved him in prison?
Yeah.
He had
a good life in prison.
He's got satellite TV in prison, yeah. And his wife can visit like every couple days. And it's basically like a prison where there's guards outside, but there's really not like bars or fences as we would understand them. You can't really leave, but you're not really like in a cell either.
I'll go this far. I think he's listening. Ugith. Hope you're enjoying the podcast, baby.
And he's got like he owns the prison basketball league or something. He's not home with his family, but it, comparatively speaking, it was not terrible.
Last thing we should mention is you're tied for the lead in the special section of the BS report.
Am I still? Nice. I haven't checked it since the other night. You know, on Friday night, I was so happy about how well I was doing in the first round. And I sent you a text message saying you really should expand my podcast repertoire to include college basketball. And then I went to bed, and then I had two teams lose in overtime, Ohio State and Florida State, who I had in the final eight. So I was like, this should teach me never to talk smack in the middle of things.
Good idea.
And then, yes. You know what? Hey, but speaking of this, brings us back to earlier conversation. Speaking of that, one of those games was Siena. Remember when Holy Cross was in the same league as Siena?
Yeah.
And we took the epic trip to Siena to watch some big game with Holy Cross and Siena with the MAC title on the line or something. And
this involves the same guy as from the What Is That story.
Exactly right. We won't get into this story, but we went to Siena, and now Siena is ranked like it has a number 9 seed in the tournament, and they're beating Ohio State. And Holy Cross is losing by 40 points to American University. What happened in 17 years to go over?
There's a little role reversal. I think you got to tell the story, though.
No, I don't know how well the What Is That story worked before. I'm not sure how good this story is going to work.
Well, it involved us. We're driving back from Siena, which was like 4 hours away.
Right, from Albany to Worcester.
And the What Is That guy was driving, and it turned into an ice storm. And he panicked. The best way I would describe it is the guy in Top Gun who they had to go save from the MiGs because he just couldn't handle it. That was our What Is That driver. And
his car had some problem with the fuel pump, so it was he kept running out of gas or something. It eventually ran out of gas.
We had to keep stopping for gas, but he wasn't exactly the model of confidence. And
no.
He was saying stuff like, "You're controlling this car as much as I am," and we're in the car like all thinking we're gonna die. And then finally, it was almost like a Lord of the Flies thing.
I ended up
driving. We rested control of the car from him, and I drove. And then we ended up finally...
The car ended up dying on the side of the road, and you and I almost killed each other. It was like Survivor in the back seat to see who was going to go and walk for help to the toll booth.
With our friend Mike Sullivan, yes.
With Mike Sullivan.
And I won that battle, and you were stuck in the car.
You physically restrained me and jumped out of the car.
Yeah.
And I stayed in the car with our friend while he threatened to cry. Yeah. And on the side of the road, in like an ice storm, hoping not to be killed by some car careening out of the ice and hitting us on the side of the road. Waiting for you to bring me safety, which you eventually did. You came and rescued us.
I mean, here's how bad it was. We were fighting to get out of the car to walk along the Mass Pike in an ice storm where we could have easily just gotten run over by any car that skidded into us.
Right.
And that was a more appealing option than staying in the car.
Right. And I ended up staying in the car. But we all lived happily ever after. So
I could have sworn that was the night that Franco helped us, the toll booth driver that you're named after.
I think we had seen Franco previously, and that night when you walked to the toll booth, you may have interacted with Franco. I think that might have been the story.
Okay. Well, all anyway. Right.
So that was Siena, and now they're they made it to the final, the second round, I guess.
Yeah.
And Holy Cross is like home watching. It's just ridiculous.
Holy cross, look at him from the sidelines.
Exactly.
All right, Johnny.
All right, buddy.
This podcast may or may not run. If it does,
yeah.
Congratulations. Thank you for your help.
Anytime.
Thank you for your measured and well thought out responses to some of my more provocative questions.
I'm here for you. I'm here to save you.
Talk to you soon.
Later.
Target percent off.
Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.
And that concludes another episode of the BS Report. And here's 55 more words that Bill Simmons intended to mention, but unfortunately ran out of time. Now you can get any regular piled-high Subway footlong for just $5. The keyword is any. The sweet onion chicken teriyaki, savory chicken and bacon ranch, the meaty taste bud-pleasing Italian BMT. All the regular famous Subway footlongs, just $5. Subway, eat fresh. See store for details.